Now to new technology in our cars. In 2009, over 30,000 Americans were killed in crashes. Most of those accidents were the result of driver error. And now, as Brett Neely reports, the auto industry wants to cut down on traffic deaths using some commonplace technology.
The car industry calls it vehicle-to-vehicle communications technology. This isn't exactly a new idea. This General Motors film from the 1939 World's Fair imagines a technology similar to what's finally making it onto roads today.
And now we see an enlarged section of 1960s express motorway. Safe distance between cars is maintained by automatic radio control.
Okay. So they were off by a few decades, but they had the basic idea right, which is that most crashes are avoidable if drivers have enough time to react. To find out more, I went to an empty parking lot in Washington, D.C., and hopped in a car with Ford Motor Company engineer Joe Stinnett. We're following two other cars closely. Too closely. It's the kind of scenario that often leads to those 60-car pileups you see on TV from time to time.
So we're just going to drive down to the end of the track here, and at the end of the track, the lead vehicle is going to hit the brakes. So you can imagine if this was a foggy or snowy day with limited visibility, this could be even worse.
All three cars are equipped with a small GPS and Wi-Fi unit, just like inside a smartphone. Ford is investing heavily in the technology and plans to launch a fleet of prototypes equipped with it this spring. It's pretty cheap, maybe $100 per car. And it lets the cars communicate things like latitude, longitude, and speed with one another at a range of about 1,500 feet.
They're monitoring the positions of all the vehicles around you and trying to determine who is an immediate threat to your vehicle and what type of threat that vehicle is.
If it looks like other cars are a threat, like the ones we're following too closely, this is what happens.
So the lead vehicle hits the brakes. So basically what you saw was you saw the lead vehicle brake lights go off, and then you immediately saw the alert go off in this car, even before you had this vehicle ahead of you, before you saw their brake lights. So you get that advanced alert.
Ford is working with most of the world's other major car makers to turn this technology into a basic safety feature of every car. This vehicle-to-vehicle communications technology will be most effective if pretty much every car on the road is equipped with it. University of Michigan safety expert James Sayer says giving drivers a few extra seconds of warning before a crash could dramatically reduce traffic accidents.
It still is the case that the weakest link is the driver. You know, the vast majority of errors in driving that lead to crashes are because of the driver. It's rarely the case that the wheel falls off.
There is one concern about this technology that the auto industry is very sensitive to: privacy. After all, cars could soon be telling every other nearby car, and who knows who else, location, speed, and where it's been in the past 5 minutes. Ford and other companies are trying to make that data as anonymous as possible. Again, here's James Sayer.
The fact that we walk around the streets with smartphones all the time means that essentially phone companies can track where we are if they wanted to. So I think there's a lessening concern on the part of the general public about the privacy.
Limited trials will start later this year. If they're a success, the government could mandate that all cars be equipped with these devices before the decade is out. For NPR News, I'm Brett Neely in Washington.
This is NPR. One news outlet has led all others in getting out word of developments from Egypt, and that's the Qatar-based Al Jazeera. Its past coverage has been controversial in this country due to a tone some American critics contend is anti-American or anti-Israel. And its English-language service has been kept off most cable systems here, but people steeped in the politics of the region say the work has been indispensable over the past week. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now from our bureau in New York to talk more about this. David, why are people now saying Al Jazeera's coverage is so important in this conflict?
Well, this is Al Jazeera's sweet spot. It's where they live. They've been doing it for one way or another 15 years. Last week, they were there with live pictures and coverage at a time when Western outlets were caught a bit short. They were caught a bit short in terms of being there and also in understanding events as they were unfolding. For example, President Mubarak has been a stalwart American ally. And so in terms of positioning this, there was a little uncertainty. You'd see it play out in the airwaves. An American journalist who was on CNN at one point even rebuked an anchor saying, look, change your caption. It says chaos in Egypt. shaped. You should change it to something like uprising or revolution, saying that the idea of chaos was playing into the hands of the regime. As well, in talking to analysts, they say that Al Jazeera has been much more sophisticated than its American and Western counterparts. For example, when President Mubarak named his intelligence chief as the new vice president, the channel's pundits instantly knew that protesters would probably recoil, as that intelligence chief has been linked to various episodes of torture there. I spoke earlier today to a former State Department official named Katie Stanton. She's now vice president at Twitter. She says everyone, including government officials here in the States, are turning to Al Jazeera as a trusted source of news, and that Al Jazeera has used Twitter aggressively to get out its reports. It helps to remember, I mean, you're talking about Jazeera's incredibly dramatic footage while a crackdown was in place. Think back to last Friday, the authorities shut down the internet, shut down cell phone traffic, and yet Al Jazeera was still broadcasting to the outside world. It was perhaps most tangible and vivid in moments where you could hear reporters telling the anchors on Al Jazeera English's feed that there were policemen at the door trying to knock down the doors to shut down the coverage. MSNBC, trying to play catch-up, was airing footage from Al Jazeera itself.
So the revolution was televised.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, part of the story here is that Al Jazeera managed to stay on the air even when there was an attempt to keep them off the air, that they were very wily in terms of continuing to report on the conflict.
I think that's exactly right. They were showing enterprise in a variety of ways, in part because they had people on the field, in part because they were using perhaps more mobile and portable ways to uplink things to satellite. At one point, you had reporters, I'm told, call into the social newsroom and sort of dictate their tweets so they could be sent out through social media networks.
So why can't we watch it on TV here in America, except in a very small number of cases?
Well, a ton of people have been watching online. That's a relative ton of people. We're told that the Al Jazeera English website saw a 2,500% jump in online visitors last week, most of it or much of it driven from the U.S. But that's a tiny percentage when you consider all the people who aren't able to see it on television. It's available in Washington area. It's available in places like Toledo, Ohio, Burlington, Vermont.
You know, Burlington, Vermont.
That's right. Little isolated areas, Burlington, known sort of liberal enclave, they may be interested in a place that's known as being somewhat more critical of United States stance. Some critics say anti-American. Some critics also say anti-Israel. There's that political touchiness around it. The cable providers say it's a business decision. Others say it's really politics. But people have been hungry for this, at least over the past week. As Yogi Berra might say, everybody's watching, but nobody can see it, at least not on television.
Hmm. So Al Jazeera has built up quite a bit of momentum with their coverage. What do they do with that?
Well, an Al Jazeera official told me earlier today they plan to relaunch a campaign they began 2 years ago. You know, 2 years ago I did a story on this about the question of where was the pickup for Al Jazeera English. You know, there's so many more channels now with digital streams, and yet they really haven't gotten that kind of distribution. They say they perhaps intend to relaunch that. They've also done other stories that have been very relevant from the Middle East lately, even to American viewers, about revelations about negotiations in Israel and Palestine, about the toppling of the government in Tunisia, another autocratic regime. And yet, so far, there hasn't been this push to pick them up. They've been sort of going around it by being viewed online.
Always good to talk to you, David. Thank you very much.
You bet.
That's NPR media correspondent David Fogenflick.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We've been exploring what we're calling the fractured culture. With so many TV channels and the breadth of the internet, what is popular with one group can go unnoticed by another. Today, video games. Gamers are not a unified group. Some are spider solitaire addicts. Others love Resident Evil. Heather Chaplin reports on one of the biggest and most intense video game subcultures.
The Final Fantasy series has sold 97 million copies around the world. But if you don't play it, you probably haven't heard of it. On a recent Tuesday, members of the NYU Game Club were hanging out, playing the latest installment in the 23-year-old franchise.
We're facing some sort of robot thing that is blocking our path in order to get to... Where are we going to? Who are we meeting right now?
That's Richard Rodriguez. He graduated from NYU last year, but he still gets together to play video games with his friends from the club, like Zeke Eberhoff.
One thing that's consistent across the series is an epic scale and operatic style to it.
As Rodriguez explains it, Final Fantasy is a role-playing game, or RPG, with origins in pen and paper games like Dungeons and Dragons. RPGs are all about heroic quests through richly drawn fantasy lands. Aesthetically, however, Final Fantasy XIII is a long way off from Dungeons and Dragons. Rodriguez describes it as lots of metal and robots in a Victorian city. The main character in Final Fantasy XIII is Lightning, a pink-haired, sword-wielding young woman out to save her sister who is in danger of losing her soul forever. Beyond that, the plot is too intricate to even begin to explain.
There's an element of world-building there.
Frank Lance is director of the NYU Game Center.
In the same way that you can disappear into Star Wars or disappear into Tolkien's universe, and it really rewards that kind of archaeological excavation where I'm just going to, like, go deeper and deeper into this piece of culture.
Frank Lance says the complexity of the game can discourage all but the most persistent.
It's so cool and seductive, the idea that there is this cryptic, mysterious, confusing thing that you have no idea. You're looking at it and you know that there's something going on there and you don't know what it is. And if you make the effort, you get to unlock that secret.
But then Richard Rodriguez is worried that the secret is being given away. New technologies like the Nintendo Wii Motion Control make it easier for anyone to play. You don't have to master a complicated set of buttons and joysticks.
I personally liked that my mom didn't understand what buttons to press and how she couldn't play the games that I was doing. It was something that was unique to my personality, and it was something that I enjoyed doing that other people couldn't.
Then again, 67 million American households already play some kind of video game or another, so the days of games as a closed club may very well be over. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.
Finally, I've been, like most people, following news of the street protests in the Middle East, and it may seem strange, but my mind keeps going back to a book I read last summer by the great former New York Times reporter Isabel Wilkerson. It is called The Warmth of Other Suns, and it's about the so-called Great Migration, the mass movement of millions of Southern blacks from the rural Southern United States to the North, Midwest, and West in the decades following the First World War up until the beginning of the 1960s. What would one have to do with the other? Can I just tell you? Both can be summed up in one powerful word, dignity. Dignity means many things, not least the ability to earn a decent living. In Tunisia, the street protest started after a man set himself on fire when a policewoman went well beyond issuing him a fine for his unlicensed vegetable cart. She also slapped him and took his dignity. For him, it was the last straw. Dignity also means the right to have both privacy and meaningful participation in the life of one's country without the iron grip of those who place themselves in charge, whether a state security apparatus or the Ku Klux Klan. Isabel Wilkerson's tremendous reporting took us into the lives of three very different people, a doctor, a sharecropper's wife, and an orange picker, who each left everything they knew for an uncertain future. One man left because he knew his life was in danger for asking for 5 cents more per pound on the oranges he picked in the hot sun. Another left because even though he wore the uniform of his country and was trained in medicine by his country, he knew he would never be allowed to fulfill his professional destiny in the town in which he grew up. So it is with those whose protests we see playing out before our eyes, so far away and yet so familiar. Their histories are certainly different, and so are their circumstances. For one thing, they share the skin color of those who oppress them, but they are oppressed in the countries in which they were born, that they call their own. They see their efforts to support their families coming to little or nothing, no matter what they do, and they've seen too many brutalized for making the smallest demands of those in power. And they cry out for justice, and those cries are ones that many of us on a visceral level understand. In this country, Black History Month is upon us once again. Here at Tell Me More, we plan to observe it with a series of 28 small essays, one for every day of the month, by our colleagues at NPR and guests on this program. We're asking them to tell us which figure from so-called Black history they most adore and why. I already know we're going to hear some fascinating stories, some well-known, many less well-known. If I were to write one, I would pick a woman I learned about only a few years ago. Her name is Harriet Jacobs, and she was an enslaved American who hid in an attic for 7 years to avoid being sold away from her two children. She did eventually win her freedom and her children's freedom, and not only that, at a time when most enslaved Americans were not allowed to read or write, she did and went on to write a powerful account of her amazing life. It's called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, and it was published in 1861. Not only that, she used the platform of the book to organize relief for other runaways who'd fled behind Northern lines during the Civil War. For a century, it was assumed that her story was a fictional account penned by a white abolitionist to win sympathy for the cause. But in a beautiful twist of fate, Harriet's story was authenticated as a true account by a woman, a white scholar named Jean Fagan Yellen, for whom it was also a journey of many years' labor and love. Too often we act as if history is something that lives in the calendar on the wall or is stuffed behind the glass in museums, but it is alive, happening around us all the time. February is as good a time as any to remind ourselves of this, as indeed the people across the ocean are reminding us right now. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.